My client, do you want me to state my name for the record? Sandra Stewart for the appellant, David Tiffany. My client, David Tiffany, has been convicted of 18 counts of child molest-related charges. And this is a man who has never been convicted of a crime before. He raised his daughter from the age of 2 until 12 with no charges ever levied against him for inappropriate conduct. The man just does not fit the usual profile of a child molester or pedophile. At the time that he was convicted, he was 50 years old, never before convicted of a crime of any kind. He pled not guilty to these charges and has at all times vehemently maintained that he is innocent of these charges. At the time that he went into court on these charges, it is my belief that he walked into the courtroom basically a guilty man and had to try to prove his innocence. He was denied most of the means of doing this. He was denied any investigation at all. He was denied bail, reasonable bail. Bail was set at $570,000, which was arbitrarily calculated based on $30,000 for each charge.
Ms. Stewart, how does that matter now? Assuming the bail was too high, wouldn't the proper procedure be challenged by a writ before the trial and ask the Supreme Court to reduce the bail? Or once he's convicted, doesn't it become a moot point?
Well, I think that it goes to whether or not his trial was fair. He was denied an investigator, and on top of that, he was denied reasonable bail, which meant that he was not able to even assist his attorney in trying to investigate his case or defend against the charges.
I'm interested in this issue of the denial of the investigator. Could you be a little more specific as to how this all happened and why he was denied? And
Well, I discussed this in my brief, and I don't have my brief in front of me, so I don't remember the exact wording that the judge used, but he said that he was basically tired of this cottage industry that was growing up of investigators being appointed in all these cases, and that it was too expensive, and that that was not required. Now, this man was facing 18 counts, many of them carrying with them life sentences.
Actually, the court said that there had to be a legitimate extraordinary reason for the investigator, such as needing to interview an out-of-state witness, and that ordinary trial preparation did not warrant granting the investigator fee. How is it in this case, and I would ask you please with reference to make your answer with reference to our Kirshner case, how it is that you believe your client was entitled to an investigator in this matter?
I believe that he was entitled to an investigator because there were several child witnesses that needed to be interviewed. It was very difficult to even get to interview them because they required, first of all, parental consent to be able to interview them. The day before calendar call, the state produced 20 hours of videotapes and 500 pages of transcripts that had to be gone through. There were numerous witnesses.
The day before trial this was produced?
The day before calendar call this was produced.
Did the defense ask for a continuance?
The defense had to ask for a continuance, and a continuance was granted, but because of calendar overcrowding, the trial had to be continued for an entire year. So that brings up also the speedy trial.
But it certainly answers the question of whether or not you had adequate time to address that which the state brought to your attention at the time of the calendar call, and it certainly would suggest you had an adequate time to prepare by and through your client to cross-examine the witnesses that the state would be presented.
Well, that would be true, except we had nobody on the street to go and interview these witnesses, unless we expect that the attorney will do that. And this court in State versus Second Judicial District provided that an indigent is entitled to an appointed investigator. Also, NRS 7.135 provides that an indigent is entitled to an appointed investigator. And basically, failure to allow a defendant the opportunity to investigate his case is is a violation of his Sixth Amendment right, to effective assistance of counsel.
So you're saying this is a due process violation rather than just simply an abuse of discretion by the trial judge?
Yes, Your Honor. I am contending that not only the failure to allow an investigator, but all of the things that this defendant was not allowed during trial to try and defend himself went to the issue of whether he had whether he received a fair trial. The bail mainly, in my mind, goes to the fact that he was not allowed an investigator, and then he was denied bail, so he couldn't go out and help his attorney investigate on his own.
And let me clarify something. I misled you with respect to asking you to follow the Kirshner case with respect to analysis regarding your investigator. That clearly goes to the psychological expert testimony. But I still haven't heard why it is that you felt beyond the indigency that your client was entitled to an investigator.
Okay, well, there were 20 hours of videotaped interviews. There were 500 pages of transcripts. I don't know what all was in that, but there were three or four child supposed victims that I know of, two of whom dropped out and were not involved in this case. Just the sheer number of transcripts suggests to me that there were a lot of witnesses. There was a previous person by the name of Hartzog who had made... spread rumors around Mr. Tiffany's daughter's school that he was a pedophile. That person should have been interviewed. The parents should have been interviewed.
Why?
To find out what their children
Were their children called as witnesses at the time of trial?
Two of the children were called as witnesses. The only evidence against this man were two juveniles who had prior criminal records. Juvenile records. He was not allowed access to those records to show their motivation to lie to save their own skin. The public defender who was originally appointed to represent Mr. Tiffany withdrew because three of these child witnesses he was currently representing on six different charges of dishonesty and drug-related charges. The defense was not allowed access to any of that information.
Given the evidence that was ultimately presented at trial, if we were to find even that the failure to provide for an investigator on behalf of your client was error, would it be harmless error?
It would not be harmless error. This went to his ability to defend himself. He was claiming that he was innocent. The only evidence against him were these child witnesses. The only way that he could prove that he was innocent was to explain why they would come into court and lie.
Didn't he also suggest in this case that even if arguably there had been some sexual conduct between he and at least Tyler, that it may have been consensual? I mean, how does that fit with his your suggestion that he was not guilty, or that he should have maintained
his guilt? That's an alternate argument, Your Honor. It's not, I mean, my client's contention is that he is not guilty. That's an alternate argument that, you know, as a matter of law, that the child consented. In fact, according to the child's testimony, he was making deals for, you know, I'll give you whatever you want, blowjob or whatever, if you'll give me a pack of cigarettes. This was the child's testimony. So that, you know, that is a legal argument that I made, but that my client's position is that he's innocent. My client was also denied a psychological evaluation of one of the children, Tyler Terrain, and yet the court found that the fact that there was no consent was not an issue because Tyler Terrain suffered from such emotional problems that he was incapable of consenting. On the other hand, the court said that my client was not entitled to a psychological evaluation of that child. In my mind, that's a double standard.
I was going to ask you, Ms. Stewart, on the issue here of the psychological examination of Tyler, and I realize you weren't the trial counsel and you're dealing with the record as it happens, but was there was it a timely request made for that, to have that psychological exam done of Tyler?
A motion was made by the public defender on December 29th, 2006. That ruling was deferred, and then the motion was renewed by appointed counsel after the public defender withdrew because of the conflict.
Okay.
So there were several requests for this psychological evaluation more than a year before trial.
Are you familiar with, I hate to go back to the investigative thing, but I just realized that the public defender, of course, has investigators. Did they do an investigation of this case at all?
Well, I have to assume that they did because they had 20 hours of videotape that they produced and 500 pages of transcripts. Another request that was made...
The PD had that or the state had that?
State had that.
What about the PD? What did they have as far as investigation of this case before, I guess, Mr. Glennon was appointed after the PD withdrew?
Right. Well, evidently the PD had started investigating the case, and that's when they discovered these witnesses, and that's when they brought the motion to withdraw. And the record isn't really clear on how much investigation they had done, but it seems since the defense had just got this information the day before calendar call, that there hadn't been too much, you know, that the public defender's office had uncovered before they brought the motion to withdraw.
So the status of the case going into that calendar call was the public defender was representing the defendant, and then they withdrew at the calendar call, and that's when this other information was produced?
I just
need to know the time frame on this.
The public defender had withdrawn before the calendar call.
How much time, do you remember?
You know, I don't remember that.
Okay.
I do remember that it was before that. And then it was Mr. Glennon,
right,
who, at the day before the calendar call, received all this information. And he had brought a motion to produce, and he had also brought a motion asking that all interviews with these children be taped so that the defense would have the benefit not only of just what the prosecution wanted to give them, but whatever these kids were saying, because the defense virtually had no access to these kids. That was denied as unheard of. And, you know, it may be unheard of in most cases, but in these types of cases, a man just accused of these kinds of crimes basically walks into court a guilty man and has to climb a very steep hill to prove his innocence. My contention is that this man was denied every means that he tried to use to prove his innocence, and that it was a complete and total denial of due process. This was not a fair trial.
When we analyzed the district court's decision to deny or to grant request for an investigator, according to Kirchner, we're supposed to look at whether a compelling need exists for the intrusion that an evaluation would cause. And the district court is supposed to weigh whether the state actually calls or obtains some benefit from an expert, whether the evidence of the offense is supported by little or no corroboration beyond the testimony of the victim, and whether or not there is a reasonable basis for believing that the victim's mental or emotional state may have affected his or her veracity. I think I have heard you address whether the evidence of the offense is supported by little or no corroboration, but can you address the other two criteria? That is, whether the state actually called an expert, and whether or not you had a reasonable basis to believe the victim's mental or emotional state would affect his or her veracity.
Okay. Under Abbott, calling an expert, the state calling an expert can also be calling a police officer. Which is what happened in this case. The police officer extensively questioned these witnesses, and it's our belief that he actually directed their comments. Tyler, who was the main witness for the state, went into the first interrogation and said no, there was no improper conduct, no improper touching. After that, the officer talked to the father. They left the interrogation room, went home. A couple of days later, the boy comes in and without any prompting at all says, oh yes, he did all these things. He molested me 1 to 10 times. So that's the point that I think speaks to the officer under Abbott was acting as as a psychological interrogator. I wanted to just, you know, I have only 15 seconds left, but the state brought up the case of Arizona versus Reams on the investigation issue, saying that indigents are not entitled as a matter of right to have paid investigators. In that case, there was no state enabling legislation allowing courts to appoint investigators, but there is in Nevada.
Thank you, Ms. Stewart.
Thank you.
Mr. Jorgensen, on behalf of the state of Nevada, Chief Deputy District Attorney.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Jorgensen, I'm going to ask you to start sort of where we've been leading Ms. Stewart, the matter of whether or not the detective acted as a psychological expert and whether or not the three prongs of Kirchner were met in this case.
Okay, and yeah, then I would like to also talk about the investigator. But as to the, let me just get my notes out. I disagree that the detective was a was used as an expert at trial. I don't. He asked the questions of the children, of course, but what? But on our direct, we did not ask anything about whether or not the kids were being truthful. We didn't ask about what you have to do to go about, you know, asking proper questions and on it. We didn't do anything to try like what was done in Abbott. We didn't do that. Stayed away from him completely. Now, it is true, if you look at the transcript, you'll see that he did testify about statements and how you're supposed to do them and everything, but that was on cross-examination. And that was done by the defense because they were setting up their expert, because they had a guy by the name of Giffen who came in from Utah that testified about how badly the statements were done. And so they asked the questions, they brought it up, we didn't bring it up, we didn't argue it, we were not using him as an expert. So, but in terms of the actual psychological evaluation, what happened was this. And let me explain a little bit more about just timing, because it'll kind of help, because it'll help about with both things. The case is, yeah, I believe it's in January of 2005 that he is arraigned in district court. And it's in front of Judge Mosley. A trial is set, and the trial is set either end of July, 1st of August. And the calendar call date, I believe, is July 26th, 2005. The public defender represents the defendant and continues to represent the defendant for quite a while. At this calendar call is what counsel was talking about with the discovery. About July 11th, there's an argument about discovery and a whole bunch of other motions that are filed by the public defenders all the time on these kind of cases. And one of them was the discovery. I had just come into the case. I had just picked it up. In fact, it was my first appearance on the case. And there was discussion about the videotapes and the transcripts of the witnesses. And they had not been provided. Now, I just picked up the case. I didn't know, you know, I mean, I was going to get ready for it, and it was in about about two and a half, three weeks away. And when I found out about that, I went and contacted Boulder City Police Department. I had the tapes, I had the videotapes and the transcripts in less than 2 weeks, and I provided them to them. Now, counsel says that the case was continued and because of that, and that was one of the reasons, but also incorrectly states that they were given to him on the day before the counter call. What the defense attorney said was this. He said, yesterday I just got the preliminary hearing transcript, and I haven't had a time to look at it. Plus, last Thursday, or 5 days before, that would be the 21st, and it's not on the record, but I believe he had him before that, but I have no doubt that that's when he actually saw him on the 21st of July. That Thursday is when he got the transcripts and the tapes. Now, he said there are about 20 hours worth of tapes and 500 pages. That was just an estimate he threw out or whatever. There never was any testimony. I can't, you know, argue. You know, I can tell you that the longest statement from the children and on the record that I know of is the one with Tyler, the main victim, and that was like about 45 minutes to an hour. And there were statements from There was the defendant's statements. There was two statements from Tyler. There was the daughter's statement. There were a girl named Kara Dugan, Sierra Gents, and John Marsh's statements. And there may have been a Greg Hoxie statement, but I never really played into it because Greg Hoxie, we couldn't locate him, so he didn't come testify. And so that was the first trial setting, and it gets continued because he just got the preliminary hearing transcript, and this is the public defender, and the discovery that we provided. And I gave it as quickly as I could. The case gets set for it. And Judge Mosley, he will set two settings. And that was my a request that I would, because I wanted to make sure that it would go faster. And so our primary setting was like in August of the next year, but we had an early January setting of 2006. Now, in an investigation, they already had, and at some point the public defender, and it's in the record, talks about having trouble talking to the kids. But they had investigators, and they were having trouble talking to the kids, not because of the lack of investigators, because the families didn't want them to talk to the defense attorneys. And so that just happens all the time. Most of the time, whether you have investigators or not, they're not necessarily, you can't force a witness to talk to somebody. Then we get later on, near December of 2005, the public defender comes in and wants to continue the case again. And he's not ready. The public defender's not ready. And wants some more, but has now says, we've gone through all this stuff, we now have more, questions that we can ask and we can use to rebut these kids' statements. So they had plenty of investigation going on before the public defender. Now,
this is George is trying to keep it in the record.
This is in the record. I'm talking about
right.
The record. And so we had, so now it's not until a couple months, so the public defender moves to continue the second trial. The first one, if we're going to say that the state was at fault because of providing this, and I don't think we are, but it was only the first continuance. The second continuance, the defense moves to continue. Then a couple months later, the public defender then moves to withdraw. And I think it's March, I'm not sure exact date, but it's a few months later. Now, we still have the August trial date. The state is very concerned about continuing on, and it's in the record in these transcripts that we have that are provided by the defense. And then we get down to the counter call in August, or it's probably July or whatever, but the summer of 2006 counter call, both the state says they're ready and the defense, and it gets continued because of crowded calendar. It's not us, it's not the defense or whatever. And at that point, in the investigation, and in the Mr. Glennon is now the attorney, and this is and about this time is when he's filing this motion for investigation.
Did the state oppose the public defender's motion to withdraw in this case, knowing that a private attorney would have to be appointed and that the person would be without an investigator and the case was alive for a long time?
I don't recall. I don't believe that. I don't think I opposed it or not. I did indicate that my only concern was I wanted to make sure the trial went the next time. But I generally don't. On a motion like that, if the trial is still months away, I'm not going to oppose it. And I don't. The only time I would oppose something like that is if it was trials coming up in a couple weeks, and I'd say no way because the trial is continuing.
Did the state oppose the appointment of an investigator?
No. We did not.
It was strictly the judge that decided that he didn't want to appoint an investigator.
No position at all on that. In fact, when I was asked that, I really want to stay out of this, whatever you want to do. But Mr. Glennon, at that time when he asked for the investigator, he said things like this. And this is in the record. He says, I am fully prepared to go to trial. He also said, I have been using an investigator. And so he already had an investigator that was doing things. What was denied was appointment for fees for more investigation. But the public defender had an investigator. He had an investigator. He was just denied more. At the same time, the court did grant the motion for the expert. That was something that, even though I didn't take a position, I said I agreed. I think that's appropriate. Now, I am sorry, I've kind of gone off, but on the independent psychic exam, so what happens is during During this time frame, and I don't, it's probably about a year before the trial or January time, about, actually, I think it was filed about the counter-call date for the January trial of 2006. Public defender files it and files a motion for independent psych evaluation. At that time, the case, and I call it, and I don't remember the name of it right now, but it was the case that was decided in between Kirshner and Abbott, the one where, in effect, if we were looking having a psych, defense wouldn't get one. That was the law at the time. Romano, we call it Romano. And so the judge, there was argument, there was pleadings back and forth. The judge did not make a determination on that. But under Romano, he would not have won that motion at the time. But it had been filed by the public defender. Now,
and I think, Mr. Jorgensen, just to clarify for my call, I think I was on the Romano case, and I believe after Romano, Abbott kind of went more back to Kirshner, you know, like that. So it kind of made, like,
yeah.
Unfortunately, many times they make a circle here, but I think that's what happened. So I understand that was the law at the time.
Yeah, the Romano, and I'm just saying it was not the law at the time that the last time we argued the independent psych evaluation. Abbott's now come out after that. So it's Abbott's now the law when we actually argue it at the time of trial in January of 2007.
You just got in the middle of a bunch of us decisions being made during
that
calendar trial. Yeah,
but right at that time, it would not have, the defense would not have won that motion, should not have won it based on a Romano case. I believe, my opinion. So then what happens, on the day of trial, the defense attorney orally requests to have a psych evaluation. And the next day, on the second day of trial, he actually files a written motion. And that's when we get it, that's when it gets argued. Now, and so I don't really have the pleadings there. I mean, I just get them and we're arguing it. So I haven't had a chance to read the cases over again. But I was aware that Abbott had in effect ruled that Kirshner is law again. And so we had the argument, and basically, and the way that I understand the law now is that the defense has the burden of presenting a compelling reason for a psychological examination of a child sexual abuse victim. And you look at three factors. You look at whether or not the state calls or obtains the benefit from an expert. You look at whether or not there was little or no cooperation for the offense, and whether or not there was a reasonable belief that the victim's mental or emotional state affected his or her veracity. Those are three things. That was argued at the time, and that was argued on the second day. I just kind of argued those things. Clearly, it was clear that I was not using an expert. I did use an expert, but only, it had nothing to do with the child. It was only in rebuttal to the defense expert, and I did not put that expert on until after the defense expert had testified. And so there was no we weren't using an expert that had anything to do with the child and talking about the child. The judge, Miriam Shearing, Justice Shearing, was hearing the trial. She heard it. She had already heard much of the corroborating evidence, and there were more than two kids that testified. There were about five or six that testified. And she had already heard that, and this motion was made in the middle of Tyler's, and he's the main victim, the one they're asking for the psychological evaluation. In the middle, I had already done my direct, and the defense had done half of their cross. And so the judge had already had the benefit of hearing Tyler, and she made the findings that there was cooperation, and that there was no evidence that had been presented that there was to present that the victim's mental or emotional state would affect his veracity. And so that was already out there. The judge made those rulings. Didn't say anything specifically about the first prong, but the state was not using an expert. So it wasn't timely. And then there's actually in the record also there was a motion, a post-trial motion, and the court then goes over it again and says also says that the defense motion was untimely. And that's one thing I argued at the time, but the judge still heard it and then made the ruling. But then but post-trial, she also said it was untimely. But if I may, let me talk a little bit about the corroboration that was there. You have John Marsh. John Marsh says that he was over there and that he was solicited for, it was solicitation for crimes against nature. That he was a, that the defendant, one time it happened on the bed and one time it happened on the couch, he woke up, John, the defendant was on his knees and said, "Can I give you a blowjob?" Something along those lines. That is almost the same thing that our, that Titer says. Titer says the first time, one of the times that he's sexually abused, he's on the couch or asleep, and he wakes up, and the defendant's on his knees touching his genital area. You've got, looks like my time's up.
I'll let you finish your thought. Go ahead.
Then you have cooperation from two girls, the defendant's daughter and another girl who, and now it has to do with John Marsh, but overhears John, the defendant, solicit John Marsh for sex, you know, to perform oral, and it's always he wants to perform oral sex on the boys. Those are the same things that the child, that Titer says, is he performed oral sex on me. It was always that. That's all the time I've got.
Well, thank you, Mr. Okay. Jorgensen.
Thank you.
Ms. Stewart, Mr. Jorgensen, thank you for your argument in this matter and your briefs. This matter will stand submitted.